The following is a special production of the Youth Media Workshop, a collaboration between WILL Radio and Innovative Ed Consulting.
In 1954, the United States Supreme Court ruled that it's illegal to segregate public schools by race. Evidence showed that separate schools for Negro and white children were not equal. The justices believed that separation of children by race generates a feeling of inferiority among Negro children that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone.
It was a civil rights movement going on in the South. A lot of people watched that on TV and in the northern areas, and wanted to improve the quality of life for everyone in their community.
More than 10 years later, during the height of the civil rights movement, at a time when civil disobedience, presidential assassination, and murders of civil rights leaders were making headlines, the Unified School District in Champaign, Illinois decided to end de facto segregation of its public schools.
The findings and recommendations were that we should racially balance the school, that separate was not equal. And the way we tried to do it, we knew we had to bring the white community along.
A 1967 teacher study of integration by the Champaign Education Association affirmed the findings of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education case. Racially isolated schools were harmful to Negro children. The Champaign School Board decided to desegregate its elementary schools in the fall of 1968.
The effect of that first desegregation plan was to cause almost all of the burden of desegregation to be placed on the black students because they were bused.
They didn't think, other than Washington School, that integration meant that the white community kids should be bused to the African-American neighborhood schools.
I had no problem with them being bused. I wanted my children to have the same opportunities as any other child had.
When we were first integrated into the school systems with white students, the white teachers had extremely low expectations of black students.
We assumed that the root of the problem had all to do with the buildings, it had all to do with the curriculum, it had all to do with the teaching core. And in fact, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the poverty that the kids lived in.
I don't know that that's ever been absolutely proven to this day, that simply the act of integration enhances the educational quality.
I think a lot of people had a lot of mixed feelings. Is it good? Was it worth it? Would we have been better off without segregation as far as education goes? And a lot of people have really strong feelings that no, we're not.
Now, 15 girls and young women of African-American descent from Franklin Middle School and Central High School investigated what happened in 1968 when Negro children were mandated to get on a bus so they might receive a better education than what was offered at their neighborhood school. The Youth Media Workshop, a collaboration between WILL and Innovative Ed Consulting, proudly present More Than a Bus Ride, Desegregating Champaign Schools. I'm Dr. Will Patterson.
And I'm Tierra Campbell of Central High School.
And I'm Veronica Martin of Central High School. We're two students who investigated the desegregation of our local public schools. We'll be your narrators for More Than a Bus Ride.
More Than a Bus Ride, Desegregating Champaign Schools, was made possible in part by a grant from the Illinois Humanities Council, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Illinois General Assembly, the Unit 4 School District, Ronald McDonald House Charities, Busey Bank, Meyer, the U of I Employees Credit Union, and First Federal Savings Bank of Champaign-Urbana.
But we are sick and tired of hearing the song, telling how you are gonna change right from wrong. Cause if you really want to hear our views, you haven't done nothing.
Neighborhood schools were the norm in Champaign before desegregation in 1968. Housing discrimination locked blacks out of many city neighborhoods. As a result, neighborhood elementary schools were mostly segregated by race and class.
One such neighborhood school was Booker T. Washington School, named after the man who rose from slavery and founded the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, one of the leading schools for black education in the United States. Derek Clements, who now lives in Atlanta, remembers his days at Washington School.
Washington School was an all-black school. You had black teachers, you had black cooks, you had the black principal. It was just a segregated school. You didn't think of segregation, oh, I'm going to this segregated school. It was a fact of life that this was one of the black schools, and everybody went there. It was wonderful because you didn't have the dissension there. You didn't have the racial prejudice because it was segregated.
Mr. Clements' younger sister, Crystal Clements, now Crystal Womble, attended Washington School too.
The teachers knew you as well as knowing your family. So, you know, if there was a situation or concern on the teacher's part for any reason whatsoever, it was nothing to see that teacher either at your house or, you know, hear a phone conversation with that teacher and my mom. For me, it seemed like there was a belief in the fact that you could learn, no matter who you were or what your background.
Marty Edwards started teaching at Washington School in 1959.
It was all black when I first started, and it was a neighborhood school. The kids were coming from the neighborhood.
What was Washington School like back then?
Well, like I said, it was all black. The black principal was a wonderful person, Mrs. Wesley. To me, it was great because I had come from a smaller school district that did not have as much as they had there. And I just thought that, ooh, I got all of this material and I can just do wonders with it. The classes were large, much larger than I expected.
Can you describe the students, teaching staff, and administration?
I guess they weren't much different from the students that I've taught. I think we had more involvement with parents. I know what we did. More involvement with the parents. We had lots of good parents that would come and help with things that we would want to do. In fact, I also like to take my kids on field trips, and I can remember never having any trouble to get parents to go along with me.
Derek Clements remembers his mother's involvement in his and his siblings' education.
Mama read each and every day, so seeing your mother read each and every day, you emulate that as a child, and so you pick up that pattern. A lot of the parents got on our case about doing well in school. During that early period, it was education that was at the forefront of the African-American family consciousness.
Washington School was to be transformed in 1968. The Equal Education Opportunities Committee, or EEOC, recommended that Washington School be dismantled as a neighborhood school and made into a magnet school. The school board adopted the recommendation.
There were 18 elementary schools in Champaign at the time. Booker T. Washington was co-operated by the Unifor School District and the University of Illinois. As a magnet school, it earned a reputation as being the best elementary school in the district. Harold Baker, chairman of the EEOC, whose son attended Washington School after it became a magnet school, explains.
We knew we had to bring the white community along. So we put forward the plan of turning Washington School into a magnet school. We were going to have all sorts of attractive things there. We were going to have small class size. We were going to have teaching assistants. We were going to have computer-assisted math teaching, and a racially balanced school. And white people were to volunteer to have their kids go, and we held out this educational magnet to them.
Dave Downey was another member of the Equal Education Opportunities Committee that created the desegregation plan.
Washington School became a magnet school, and it just happened that my son was among the first students to go there. We lived right next to Westview School, but he got on a bus at Westview and went to Washington, as did my two daughters when they became of age to go to school. But it was as usual, and you know, not surprisingly, there was an outcry in the community and from the black leadership that it was an unfair burden on the black kids to have to be the ones primarily moved. And yet the decision was made that the education quality would be better and it was worth the effort to get it done. And actually we had some complaints because there were a number of black parents who would have liked for their kids to have gone to Washington School, but because of the percentage issues, could not get them admitted.
Julian Rappaport, a psychology professor at the University of Illinois, enrolled his children in Washington School too.
We came to Champaign in 1968. From the time we arrived here, we had heard about Washington School. Booker T. Washington had become a magnet school. Before we started my youngest daughter in 1971, we visited the school, and we were immediately struck by the social environment, especially the principal at that time, a woman named Mrs. Wesley, who was African-American principal, very warm. Her eyes lit up when she saw kids. As we walked in the hall, I always remember her, little kids running down the hall to her and her picking them up and hugging them. And it was just seemed like such a nice place to go to school.
How did you feel about your children being taught by African-American teachers?
Well, here's one of the ironies of the experience. There weren't very many African-American teachers, which, looking back on it, seems surprising. Although they had African-American peers, the staff did not, at that time at least, have many African-American members.
One of the drawbacks and one of the unexpected or unintended results often that happened in terms of trying to integrate the faculty of the schools is some of the best black teachers who had been in predominantly black schools were then moved to predominantly white schools.
Maudie Edwards taught at Washington before and just after it became a magnet school.
I really enjoyed when we got the lab school from the University of Illinois because the government had given them the money to, we could do whatever we wanted to. We could plan, we could go on trips. I can remember they sent two of the teachers all the way to Boston once to a conference, and we just had so much material and so many books, and then we had two professors from the university that came in to help us too. That was one thing that I really enjoyed.
Mrs. Odelia Wesley was the principal at Washington School when it was a neighborhood school and after it became a magnet school. Here she is talking about Washington School in this excerpt from a 1969 TV documentary.
Subject to it being said as one of the poorest schools in the district, because this has never been a feeling of mine. And I think if we can say it's one of the better schools in the district now, it certainly is our plan that we have of integration, which is a motivational factor for some of our children. It stimulates them to want to do more and to do more. I think it can be attributed to the help that we have. I think it can be attributed to the different kinds of materials that we have. And it gives us a chance to work with different materials and techniques and so forth, and to try to find those that are most effective in working with children. And it is the purpose of our school that when we find these materials and techniques, that they will eventually be placed in some of the other schools too, not just Washington School. This is a testing ground for all schools in the district.
John Lee Johnson, a community activist, has been an advocate for the black community for more than 40 years.
Magnet schools were allowed under the Supreme Court ruling as a means of attracting the white community into the black community. Now, remember that the emphasis of the whole DSEG case by the NAACP was not asking white people to bring their children to the black community. It was asking the court to allow black children to go to white schools, okay? And the reason for that emphasis probably was on the fact that black schools did not meet the same quality as white schools. And they probably felt that because of that, it would be much better for black kids, wherever they were in the American public school systems, to leave their buildings and to go into white schools.
Julian Rappaport, whose daughters attended Washington School, agrees.
Washington School was an attempt to attract white families, and it seemed like a good idea to us for our kids to get to know African-American kids as well as white kids. And also Booker T. Washington, the way they went about making it a magnet school was that they had developed programs in association with the university. They had a big grant from the National Science Foundation to improve science and math. They were teaching foreign languages. It was a pretty active school, and it got very good publicity among the university community.
Max Bieberman, a professor of math education at the University of Illinois and a leader in the New Math Movement, believed that the presence of white children in a classroom would increase the performance of black children. Here is Professor Bieberman from a 1969 documentary.
Assuming that was the case that in the past graduates of the Washington School scored lower the graduates of other elementary schools in Unit 4 on various achievement tests. I think that situation will change because we have changed the mix of student body in each of the elementary schools.
The assumption by the school board and other people that the children who lived around Washington were inferior to the white kids that were being bused from the South to the schools, and the promise that the Board of Education had made to those parents that we were providing you with an exceptional education that you can't get anywhere else in the district but at Washington School, and to assure you of that exceptional accelerated curriculum, we're only going to bring in children of color who can match your children's learning speed, and that there would be nothing that would slow your children down in learning.
Mrs. Hester Nelson Suggs was the first principal of Washington School after Mrs. Wesley. We asked her about some of the concerns expressed about Washington School when it was an all-black school.
They had lower test scores, but I'm not sure that the test scores were really indicative of what kids could do, or they were indicative of what was tested at that particular time. I know teachers that taught kids how to read, that the kids were said that they couldn't read prior to that particular time. They had some problems, but I think the problems were a result of the whole kind of neighborhood rather than the school casting aspersions on the school itself. They had good students and they had poor students.
How did busing impact people's view about Washington?
I think they thought that Washington School had all select students, which really wasn't right, because we had to, even at Washington School, save a certain number of students out from the area. They did that to get other students to come into Washington School, to get non-minority students to bus into Washington School so they could have at least one integrated school.
Many of the black children from the Washington School neighborhood were now bused to schools in South Champaign. Vernon Barkstall, then president of the Urban League and a member of the Equal Education Opportunities Committee that created the desegregation plan, strongly objected to the way in which Washington was set up as a magnet school. In a statement of concern written December 6, 1967, Mr. Barkstall wrote,
"Volunteerism should be a two-way street, but any way you slice it, as many as 74% to 93% of the Negroes now attending Washington School will have no choice as to whether or not they attend the best elementary school in the district. The model school concept of Washington School is merely a pacifier to the white community and has no moral basis in fact, either real or implied."
In another statement of concern written on December 13, 1967, Mr. Barkstall wrote,
"A lion's share of the volunteers will no doubt come from racially liberal homes. Thus, the cross-section of the community for which we strive cannot be assured. In this racially balanced school, the number of Negroes able to attend is entirely dependent upon the number of whites willing to volunteer. The option of volunteering or not on the part of whites weakens the valid argument that racial isolation is detrimental to all of our youngsters and the valuable opportunity to effectuate some positive change in attitudes in the area of human relations."
Julian Rappaport agrees with the criticism.
So Washington School was declared not a neighborhood school. So anybody who wanted to go there, including neighborhood kids, would have to apply to go there. It's not clear to me how many neighborhood kids or neighborhood families understood this. And not very many neighborhood families would sign their kids up to go to Washington School, I think not realizing that they had to sign up to go there. And plus, Champaign was already busing large numbers of African-American kids to other schools, so they thought that they would just get bused to whatever school they were assigned. So people like Mrs. Wesley and other staff members would actually have to go out into the neighborhood and recruit kids to sign up to come to Washington School.
Community activist John Lee Johnson.
"There's nothing bad with chartered or other Pacific schools as long as those schools do not lock out children who reside within those neighborhoods. One of the reasons that we included Washington School in our racial complaint that was filed in 97 against the Champaign schools because it locked out the children who live closest to the school, and they were not allowed to attend that school. But if we would have been a little bit more intelligent, we may have been able to get better schools in Northeast Champaign with more white kids attending those schools instead of having a situation where structurally all of our kids were uprooted and sister schools in Southwest Champaign.
Black children from Northeast Champaign were bused to elementary schools in South Champaign. Kenwood Elementary School was one such school. In 1968, it was about 98% white. Nearly all of the black children who attended Kenwood were bused in. Rose Gamble, principal of Kenwood at the time, talked about the changes in this excerpt from a 1969 documentary.
Well, I feel that busing is a good thing for the school and for all the children that live here, as well as the children that are bused in. Perhaps some of these children have never known black children before, and they are sitting in class with them and playing with them and finding out that they are children just as they are. I think there is a big advantage for the children that are being bused in. They have a low opinion of themselves, and the most important thing for a child to learn is to have a good self-concept. And most of these children do not have a good self-concept. Of course, we have children here that do not have a good self-concept, too.
One of the concerns raised about busing black children from segregated school was the expectations of white teachers. Again, Max Bieberman, University of Illinois professor.
I think it is a common problem to find teachers who expect lower achievement from black children that they are actually capable of. There have been some interesting experiments conducted on the West Coast where investigators told teachers in advance that certain ones of their children were going to become academic bloomers. And in point of fact, there was no evidence to substantiate this. But those children whom the teachers knew were going to be academic bloomers did in fact bloom academically. There is a lot to be said about the expectations of teachers with respect to the achievement of children.
Here again is Principal Gamble of Kenwood Elementary School in 1969.
In order that children learn and do well in school, they must think that they are able to do that. And then the teacher's expectation is very important. If the teacher doesn't expect much from children, she won't get much. It is hard for a middle-class teacher to understand all children. Her life is quite different than the child that comes from a home where they don't have food, clothing, and the parents aren't there. But Champaign has done a good job in trying to educate their teachers. We've had workshops last summer.
Some of the workshops Principal Gamble refers to were called Little Black Sambo Revisited,
Down Home, The Southern Way of Life in the Ghetto,
and Educating the Negro Child, Progress or Poison. According to a report from the Unit 4 School District, about one-fourth or 250 teachers and administrators attended the workshops. Mrs. Suggs, principal at Washington School, remembers some of the workshops.
It gave us both positive information and information that was correct and information that probably was a little bit tainted the way that as perceptions, but it was to work on teachers' perceptions because their perception was that they were going to get all these inferior kids coming into the school, and it wasn't necessarily true. Black children in Champaign's mostly segregated Northeast End were bused to racially balance the elementary schools. Harold Baker was chairman of the committee that created the desegregation plan.
We didn't want tokenism. We didn't want two or three to come. We wanted to balance it in accordance with the, or in conformity with the makeup of the community.
John Lee Johnson was one of a small group of black people in Champaign who opposed busing to racially balanced Champaign schools. He opposed the way in which school districts across the country created their desegregation plans.
What the white communities did in our community, and they did in most places in the country, that they tore down the schools in the black community, they closed them, and then therefore forced the black community to attend their schools. those schools that they had that were old, as our schools were old, they simply tore them down and built new schools. But they built these new schools in their neighborhoods or on agricultural sites, which ultimately they built neighborhoods around. Black people thought then it was a good deal because your kids were going to be able to go and sit down in the same room with white children. And they thought it was a very, it was not a hard price to pay, that white kids were allowed to walk to their schools and blacks would have to be bused to theirs. No one talked about homework time. No one talked about activities before schools, activities after school. Those kinds of discussions did not go into it.
Derek Clements no longer attended his neighborhood Washington Elementary School. He was bused to Lottie Switzer Elementary School as part of the desegregation plan.
It was a mixed bag of nuts with the teachers because as a youngster, when we were first integrated into the school systems with white students, the white teachers had extremely low expectations of black students. And this teacher, Mr. Poole, he didn't want to teach black kids at all. I mean, he was just, you could just tell it, you know, because with the other students in the class, he took the time, he's speaking all nice and everything, and he's giving the explanations and stuff. And then when it comes to one of his black students asking questions, it's cut and dry and quick and this and that. I got out of that class and I said, listen, I can't deal with this.
Before Derek Clements was bused to Lottie Switzer School, he was tested by students from the University of Illinois.
Well, I remember when we were tested, that wasn't that happy of a moment because as a youngster, you're told that you're going to be taken and then you're going to be put over into the white schools. And it was an uneasy feeling because it was like, yeah, so I got to leave all my friends over here and I have to go to the white school with white kids and they don't like me. And I see what goes on TV and I see what they're doing to the people in Selma and the riots. And I see how they're treating people on the bus with the water hoses and the dogs sicking them on them. And, you know, a lot of this stuff's happening down south, but the feeling that you get is like, well, I'm going to be bused to this strange school with white kids. Are they going to, you know, are we going to get along? And when we got over to the white school, especially Switzer, it was a whole new world. I mean, you had a little bit of everything. The books were brand new books, pens and pencils whenever you needed them. You had plenty of paper. You know, when in the black schools, you know, you'd be scrounging for stuff and your books are old and tattered, you know.
Well, when you went to Switzer School, what was it like to be bused?
To be bused, it was a weird feeling because you had the black kids and we were the ones who were, I guess you call some of the chosen ones, you know, who were chosen to go to this white school. And so we felt very special. So you felt special, but then again, it was a eerie kind of feeling because once we got there and things began to settle in, it was a feeling as though, wow, it's not like being at the other school. The teachers really don't care for us that much, and they talk to us, some of us, real different, and then some of us they talk to really harsh. That was not a good feeling.
How did your social life change as a result of the change in schools?
My social life changed tremendously because now being bused to an all-white school, I made new white friends now. And your white friends who you're now meeting, a lot of them you find out, they are certainly not as intelligent as you are. But you're led to believe that all white kids are wonderful and bright and superstars, and they have these brilliant minds because you're watching television, you see this Leave It to Beaver, you see the white families, you know, and they're this fantastic family with the smart little kids and everything. And then you get into school in reality and you find out they just got some really backward white folks.
Rebe Hunt is a parent whose three children were bused when Champaign's elementary school were racially balanced in 1968. Mrs. Hunt grew up in Tennessee and attended all black schools. Busing was part of her childhood.
We was bused all the way past the white schools to an all-black high school in McKenzie, Tennessee. I was bused like about almost 20 miles each way. If you had a determination to go to school, that's what you had to do. You had to get on the bus. It wasn't even daylight. And then go to the little town, transfer to another bus, and then go to school. And when you got back, you got on the bus, and then you didn't get off again until night. Mm-hmm. So it was sun up to sundown if you wanted to go to school, and that's what we had to do. But as a young person, I was determined that I was going to school. So that's what I had to do, so that's what I did.
Mrs. Hunt believed that the benefits of busing for her children outweighed the costs.
I had no problem with them being bused. The reason I had no problem with them being bused, I wanted my children to have the same opportunities as any other child had. My child didn't really have to sit in the same classroom with a white child, but I wanted them to have the same material, the same books, not have outdated, worn-out books. The same books. I had no problems with the teachers at Washington School. They was very good teachers. But they was at a handicap because they didn't have the material that they needed to work with. I was the kind of mom that was at the school all the time. So when they did integrate, I was over at the school every day at lunchtime, every day.
How did white teachers treat your children?
I think most of them treated my children pretty good because they knew that I was going to be at the school. They knew that I was going to know what was happening, what was going on. So if you want your children treated fair, you have to get involved. That's the key. You have to get involved. And I stayed involved.
You are young, gifted, and black.
We must be.
There's a world waiting for you.
Yours is the quest that's just begun.
I taught everything. I taught reading, writing, spelling, math, even singing. I taught everything.
Maudie Edwards taught at Washington School when it was a neighborhood school and shortly after it became a magnet school.
Mrs. Edwards was eventually transferred from Washington School to Robeson Elementary School in South Champaign. Robeson was approximately 98% white at the time.
Were there any black teachers still at Washington School when you transferred to Robeson?
Yes, there was. They split us up. I think they might have left three teachers there, black. And then they brought, well, it could have been more than that. They brought some of the white teachers over or hired new teachers.
According to school district documents, during the first year of the desegregation plan, all continuing elementary school teachers were first assigned or reassigned to schools other than Washington School, so that there would be non-white teachers at each elementary school wherever possible.
After teachers received their assignment, they could ask to be reassigned to Washington School. There were 10 factors to be considered for selection to teach at Washington. Mrs. Edward ended up at Robeson School.
Was the population at Robeson School different from Washington School?
Yes, it was. It was mostly white because it was a lot of walk-ins, and there were no black people living out there at that time.
Were there ever times when you just wanted to quit your teaching career because of a white parent and their comments?
No, I always had good answers for my white parents. I remember one parent that came, she had moved into the area. She'd moved, I don't know from where, and the principal had given me her son. And she, of course, didn't know I was black. She was so upset that I was a black. She just turned her color change. She didn't know what to say. And she really didn't want him in there, but it was nothing. The principal was with her. I was there. And she was really didn't, she had no idea how this child was going to react to me. And, of course, the child was afraid. The child sat there and she looked at me like she thought I was an animal. Her eyes followed me around. Because they had not lived in the area long, and they probably had not, maybe the child had never been that close to a black person. She always liked to sit sort of away from everybody, because I let them move their chairs where they wanted to, and this little black boy came by, and she said to him, "You's a nigger." And I heard her, and he didn't know what the word nigger was. I don't believe he did, but she had been taught that that's what we were. And he just went on in the restroom and came on out. And so when he came out, I came over to her and I said, would you come in the restroom with me? I want to talk with you. And she came and she didn't know what she'd done wrong. I don't know. But I said, you never, never, never let me hear you say that word anymore, because that's not a good word. I said, did you know that was a bad word? And tears started running down. She was so unhappy. She cried and cried. I said, now wipe your eyes, but please don't ever say that word anymore in the classroom, because that's not nice. But she didn't know, because she's heard that at home.
Blacks could not live where they wanted to in Champaign, according to a report issued in 1967 by the school district. Integration and housing began around 1957 with the help of the Council for Community Integration. The council worked on integrating all white neighborhoods and worked with individual black families to find them housing. After blacks picketed real estate agencies for their practices in 1963 and 1964, Barr and Squires became the first white real estate agency to state that they would show houses to Negroes. Alvin Griggs moved from the South to Champaign in 1963, where he taught for 29 years.
The changing of the housing situation, which allowed blacks to purchase homes all over the community, had the biggest effect on me. And when that happened, blacks started moving all over the community. And they moved out in the Centennial area and other areas in the community. And that made a difference in the schools. You didn't have to worry about busing. They lived in the community.
People get ready. There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board.
There was only one public high school in Champaign, Champaign Senior High School, later known as Central High School. Then in 1967, a second high school, Centennial High School, was built in the southwest part of Champaign.
Lila Jean Eichelberger was one of the first teachers at Centennial High School.
We moved into an incomplete building. We had no cafeteria. We had no gymnasium. Our offices were makeshift offices and classrooms. And there was only a gravel road from Jefferson up to Centennial. There were no streets to it. We were right out in the middle of a cornfield.
Mr. Griggs was a physical education teacher, a coach, and later an administrator at Centennial High School.
The kids from the North End were bused to Centennial High School. And many of the people in the white community thought it was going to be the white school in Champaign for the elite, and that Central was going to be Central High School now, was going to be the city school for the kids in the city. Well, that didn't turn out like that.
How did the school prepare African Americans for busing?
They didn't.
Al Davis was a counselor at Centennial High School when it first opened and later became a principal.
My sense was that there were some people, I wouldn't say all, but there were some people who kind of expected that to be a high school just for those people in Southwest Champaign. I don't think some people ever thought that that was going to be an integrated school. There was really no preparation, or at least none that I know of, made in terms of preparing the students for being bused to Centennial.
I think some of the challenges once you got there was just to kind of prove that you had a right to be there. You know, you were there to learn. You should be afforded the same opportunities that everybody else.
Crystal Clements was bused to Centennial from Northeast Champaign.
And I think some of the challenges, you know, kids, they were wondering, well, who are we and what were we doing there? And we were wondering the same thing. Mr. Griggs was there. He was one of the dean of students, so, you know, I knew him and he knew my family from B.T. Washington days. So you still had some people that were, in a sense, kind of looking out for you, making sure you were where you're supposed to be, you were doing the right thing. If you had concerns, you could always come to those key people. And then I think there were other teachers and counselors who maybe consciously or subconsciously weren't quite sure how they were going to handle having black kids in the school and what that meant overall.
Why do you think there weren't that many African Americans in the higher classes?
I think a variety of reasons.
Al Davis, former counselor and principal at Centennial.
You have to remember that segregation that existed in the Champaign schools prior to 1967 was a time when African Americans were participating in segregated schools. And segregation carries a pretty heavy price. And it affects aspirations, what people want to do, what they feel they can do. And so all of the things, both in terms of not only taking courses, but more importantly, feeling that going to college, taking advanced level courses was a thing to do, that simply didn't exist in Champaign at that time. And as a result, students came to Centennial and they were not prepared in terms of having taken the courses that would have prepared them for college-bound track, and they had not been encouraged and motivated to take those kinds of courses and to pursue careers that would require a college education.
Being bused to Centennial High School made it difficult to attend after-school activities.
We had to get the bus and go home. A lot of parents were poor, and they didn't have a second car, or they didn't have, both parents were working, and the mother couldn't come and pick up the child, or we couldn't stay after to get tutoring or so forth, because we had to take that bus to get home.
Jackie Smith attended Centennial for 2 years. She was the only Black cheerleader on the squad and was also on the student council.
Because of the way that I was raised, my mother taught me to accept every situation that was dealt to you, whether it was bad or good, to deal with it as a challenge, which meant she was also challenged because I was a cheerleader and I was in student council. I was president of the student council, and it was just my nature to be active in school. So therefore, I just participated in things that we didn't even have money to buy me sweaters for the cheerleading and stuff. But my mother and father would work extra because they knew that they had taught me not to let racism be a barrier.
Coach Griggs remembers the challenges faced by students who were bused and wanted to be in after-school activities.
First, we asked for late buses, and they started running late buses around 5 o'clock. Then after the late buses, we put in, when they started the MTD, we asked for tokens, and then we would give the students tokens. They used the bus tokens. And then we did something that was illegal. Would you believe that? We got some old cars, and we left them behind the building with the keys in them. So when they finished their practice, they would get in the cars and drive them home and drive them back the next morning. And the coaches would take them back. And the coaches would take some of the students home. I did. A lot of the coaches would drive the students home.
So I would like to say that we're one tonight. Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
Will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live. Lila Jean Eichelberger taught vocational education for more than 20 years at Centennial and made visits to her students' homes.
What was Champaign like in 1968? What was the climate like, and what were challenges and struggles?
Things were rather tense. I visited all of the homes of my students, and sometimes they would tell me, now you can't go here or you can't go there. As long as you're with us, it's okay. When a white woman went into the African-American community, some of the people wondered why they were there.
Blacks were already agitating locally for change when Centennial opened. There were boycotts of stores such as JCPenney's for refusing to hire Blacks as store clerks. There were pickets of downtown department stores for refusing to allow Blacks to sit at the lunch counters, although they could buy from the store. Some of Mrs. Eichelberger's Black students joined the protest.
Well, they just came in and said, guess what we did yesterday? And I said, well, what did you do yesterday? And so they said, we sat at the lunch counter at Grant's. And I said, what happened? And they said, nothing. I said, good.
Derek Clements attended Centennial High School and graduated in 1975.
Integration had already taken place. the racial makeup was predominantly white, and the white kids that lived in that area, their mothers and fathers owned land. Some of their mothers and fathers would be business people. They may work downtown, they may work for the city, or they may work for the University of Illinois. Then you had the black kids who were bused into Centennial. Centennial was this brand new, beautiful, differently built school and stuff. But the feeling there was that you black kids, you don't live here. We live here. You're on the other side of town. You guys just come in here. So there was a very high degree of racial unrest there.
How did you get along with other students and teachers?
I got along very well with the students and the teachers there because, and I think it was, I love for it to go down in history. At Centennial, we had a small group of African Americans, boys and girls, and we had a friendship with another group of white boys and girls, and it was true, it was really true friendship. We hung with some of the white kids as friends, and they hung with us. We got a lot of flack from some of the other students and stuff like that, but we would participate in activities outside of the school life with some of our white friends. And they would participate in activities with us as well. We'd have a great time. And that happened to be one of the happiest moments of my life because we had white friends and we would go out and have a great time. And we weren't thinking about, oh, yeah, well, you know, you're white, you're black. It wasn't about that. It was just about living your life as a youngster.
Despite some interracial friendships, there were riots at Centennial in the 1970s. The people we interview, former teachers, students, and the assistant principal, share their memories of what happened during one of the riots.
I was coaching and was told that some kids were coming to school, white kids coming to school, with axe handles, and they did. And I think the administration called for police to come out and give us a backup, but the police decided to go take the Savoy route, and they didn't show up.
I was an assistant principal. And I received a call. There were some white students with whatever, bats or boards or clubs, some kind of, quote, weapons. And they were standing around their cars or standing around their trucks and so that they were visible. And so when that occurred, I immediately called the police to report that. And that only took a moment. And then I went downstairs to the south end of the building and noticed that there were no police cars there. So I put in a second call to the police, and then I went outside.
When we pulled up to Centennial on the bus, there was a group of around, I'll say maybe around 25 white kids, and they were waiting to whoop our butts. They had bats, they had sticks, they had little chains. One or two of them, I know, I remember seeing they had brass knuckles and whatever else they had weapons, and they were waiting for us with the weapons in their hands, waiting for the black kids to get off the bus because they was going to whoop our ass.
We saw all of these grown men with hard hats on, and we were confused. We're like, what is that about? You know, they were fathers. They were construction workers. They weren't just kids, but they were students mixed with them.
A group of white males met the bus of the African-American students and weren't going to let them come in. And the African-Americans were more clever at handling situations like that, and so they took over.
The white boys came and they forced the doors open. The black kids, we got off the bus because we felt we were more vulnerable being on the bus because then they might have thrown rocks or bricks at the windows and stuff like that. We got off the bus only into the waiting arms of white kids who were swinging at us with bats and fists and stuff like that. A lot of the kids who were getting off the bus were swung at and hit and grabbed, pushed down, maybe kicked. And it was like down south. You know, it was like, hey, everybody going to get a little tag on these niggas, excuse my language, because that's what they called us.
So when the black kids found out what was going on, they did take some of the axe handles, and they went in the building and very upset. Now, they did have a few kids that were injured with those axe handles, one seriously injured.
It was a frightening experience to see people coming down the hall and throwing garbage cans through glass plate windows and things like that. I never felt in any danger.
It was just such chaos, and They had locked the doors. The teachers who were in the classroom with the white children and some black children had locked the doors to keep people out. They were trying to be safe. So on my way to my classroom, one of the teachers was into a fight, and he got his glasses knocked off of his eyes, and I picked up his glasses, and he was hurt. And I got expelled from school, not expelled, I'm sorry, kicked out from out of school for being outside when they had closed the doors. It was just such penalties to being black at that particular time and being bused that it just carried such negativism to it that it was a hurtful experience.
There was a distinct difference in the discipline that was given to white students and to black students. A lot of the black students were expelled from school. Some of the white students were expelled for just a few days. Some of them were not. And it was like day and night.
It was the feeling that among white students that African-American students were not being disciplined, that they were getting away with doing things and nothing was happening. And so they were going to take matters into their own hands and try to resolve whatever the problem was.
I think the straw that broke the camel's back was when one of the African-American boys had gone with a white girl, and that ensued an argument and a fight and hatred.
It wasn't a good feeling. It was a very bad feeling to have to be forced to fight. But we did fight, and we kicked some ass, I'm sorry to say, but it was not good. A lot of people got hurt.
They closed the school down for several days, and they had community meetings. And I attended all those community meetings. They were mostly white, and I sat in on those meetings. There was some very negative comments and some things that I didn't feel very comfortable with, but I was able to sit through those meetings.
After the riots, the principal was fired, and Al Davis became the new principal. He hired Alvin Griggs to be assistant principal and tried to build new relationships and trust with local African-American communities.
I started going to meeting in homes. I would have coffees in homes, in African-American homes. I'd find a parent, say, why don't you invite some of your neighbors, some of your friends who have children at Centennial, and I'll come out, meet with them, talk with them.
It's been nearly 40 years since Champaign ended de facto segregation of its public schools. How is that decision perceived today?
I don't know that that's ever been absolutely proven to this day, that simply the act of integration enhances the educational quality. I think it enhances the socialization quality, but I'm not so sure that the same amount of money and energy spent in the neighborhood school might have accomplished the same thing.
I think the key is that everybody needs to have equal access. And I think that's what we miss a lot of times. You know, it's not so much where you go to school at, but the fact that you get the quality education that you're entitled to get.
Herb Stevens, John Lee Johnson, along with four African-American parents with children in the Unifor School District, sued the district in 1997 over the achievement gap between African-American students and white students. John Lee Johnson.
We quite simply did not understand then, and we don't understand now, the impacts of a desegregated educational system. There appears to be such inherent difference between black kids and white kids that teachers simply can't figure out this difference and can't teach that difference equally.
Well, it wasn't ever a question of inferiority. It could have been in white people's mind, some white people, but that was not a question. There were learning years difference between the two races. Whites scored more better in math, languages, other areas of curriculum than blacks did. But that had, in essence, really nothing to do with the segregated schools. That had more to do with the poverty of black kids. The reason for that is that now that we have deseg schools and black kids are attending newer facilities with better curriculums, that gap, that learning gap still exists. 30, 40 years later, that learning gap still exists. But we didn't know that then. We didn't know that. We assumed that the root of the problem had all to do with the buildings. It had all to do with the curriculum. It had all to do with the teaching core. And in fact, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the poverty that the kids lived in, because there's a real difference in preparation, is that white families spend more time in preparing their children for school than black families. So as a result of that difference in preparations, when white kids get there, they can be 1, 2, or even 3 mean years ahead of their black counterpart. Black families have not figured that out. Today, there are different issues. You know, there are different issues. We're not talking about structurally tearing down buildings and all of that there. We're talking about achievement, learning gaps. We talked about it then. But the gap then, we thought, would be closed by the desegregation of the schools.
After you sued the Unified School District, what kind of changes occurred?
Very little. There were changes that occurred. We got the court to overlook the school district, which it is now. We have a monitor who serves the court in auditing what the schools are doing or not doing and reporting that to the court. We have a policy implementation committee that's made up of citizens, school officials, and a university professor of education who helps in interpreting and setting policies and guidelines for the schools towards the consent decree. But I'm looking at it as, how many kids are actually improving in their learning? How many kids are not being dumped into special education? How many kids are not being put in alternative education? How many kids are being sent to upper level courses? Those numbers are not changing. We're into 2.5 years, and those numbers have not changed.
Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. Mm-hmm. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow.
So the desegregation process that began in 1968 is still going on. The achievement gap between African-American students and white students is as wide, if not wider. Putting African-American children on a bus and driving them to the other side of town did not accomplish all that people had hoped.
Our public schools still need something more than a bus ride. I'm Veronica Martin of Central High School.
And I'm Sierra Campbell of Central High School. We hope that this program has challenged you to make connections between what's happening in our schools today and what happened then.
More Than a Bus Ride, Desegregating Champaign Schools, is a production of the Youth Media Workshop, a collaboration between WILL and Innovative Ed. For more information, including full interviews, transcripts, and desegregation documents, as well as information about us, the students who created this program, go to WILL.UIUC.edu. That's WILL.UIUC.edu.
This program was created by Yakira Barbie, LaPortia Bailey, Jamie and Jasmine Brown, Tierra Campbell, Gabrielle Caesar, Abrisha Cotton, Asia Gross, Brooke Harris, Veronica Martin, LaWanda Miller, Jacinda Rogers, Danielle Russell, Shanika Taylor, and Sharnice Whitaker. We researched the desegregation process, conducted the interviews, and edited stories with guidance from WILL.
More Than a Bus Ride was co-directed and co-produced by Kimberly Chronic of WILL and Dr. Will Patterson of Innovative Ed, technical instructor and finishing editor Dave Dickey, Franklin Middle School teachers Shamim Rakai and Sherry Murphy, website support by Jack Brighton.
Let us know what you think about More Than a Bus Ride. Send your comments to WILLAMFM@UIUC.edu. That's WILLAMFM@UIUC.edu. Or call our listener comment line, 217-333-0853. That's 217-333-0853.